standoff, you know, PVC standoff, so the wire. The tree stalk of is that the tree sent the stalk on an evergreen. You know, the way an evergreen looks, it's not as dense. It actually has branches the way they come out. You can actually use them as steps to climb up the tree. But what I have is a these standoffs, these PVC standoffs. So actually, the wire does not touch the tree at all. No, I put the kilowatt into it many a time to take over.
But it is something to be concerned about. Getting back just for about five sentences on the previous subject of last week on single sideband generating techniques. There's at least three or four ways of generating sideband. And if you simply Google the word single sideband or single sideband generators, you'll be able to read about the phasing technique, the filtering technique, the Costas technique. There is a very famous McGraw-Hill book where the author of the book was Papenfuss, P-A-P-E-N-F-U-S-S, phonetically. I don't know the exact spelling of his name. But Papenfuss, McGraw-Hill, Single Sideband Techniques, I think is the name of the book. And there they go through the theory of it. And there's a lot of theory there. But single sideband is what, in my opinion, more than 90% of all of the speech being used by ham radio operators on the HF bands and even the UHF and VHF bands, 90% or more of all the speech is single sideband. Very, very effective technique. We did cover FM 2 weeks ago, and I don't think we should go over that one again, even though you mentioned it in two transmissions ago, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, now the questions were asked FM about some questions about single sideband, but okay, yes, I guess it's either too large a subject to get into step by step by all the different methods. And to start explaining them, basically they're looking for simple explanations of one system over another and the advantage of one system versus another. But here's one question that's come up. I've seen pictures of oscilloscope patterns of single sideband signals. How do they go about getting those single sideband patterns on? Well, I guess, you know, they want to know how can you use a simple oscilloscope, basically, to look at a single sideband signal, Dick, over.
If you just took a A-scope, in other words, a ordinary oscilloscope, where the vertical axis represents voltage and the horizontal axis represents time, and you let the oscilloscope sweep naturally, with or without internal synchronization, you can look at a single sideband signal as long as your oscilloscope will respond at that particular RF frequency. Interpreting that signal on the oscilloscope would be difficult. The next step is to not use the normal horizontal sweep of the oscilloscope, but you use external horizontal input, where now you take the audio that's going into the microphone and use that audio directly to deflect the horizontal sweep of the oscilloscope, while the vertical axis is now creating the actual RF signal voltage. You do that, you get a double trapezoid, you get a double diamond or a double trapezoid pattern on the screen, which now is quite easy to interpret. You look at the earlier issues of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where they literally told you to do just that in order to properly adjust the single sideband transmitter for linearity, crossover distortion, flat topping, and whatever. So now what's happening, let me drop, is that the instant you have a positive peak in the audio, whether it be a sine wave or you whistling or you saying hello or whatever in the microphone, at the instant there is a positive peak of audio voltage, the oscilloscope is being deflected to the right. At that instant of time, is producing maximum power. So you get a great big deflection on the right-hand side screen, a vertical deflection on the right-hand side. And during the time that you hit the negative peak of voltage come into your microphone, the oscilloscope is on the left-hand side of the screen with a great big voltage. And when you don't speak into the microphone, you get a dot in the center of the screen with no vertical deflection because you're not creating any RF. no horizontal deflection because you're not creating any audio. And now you fill in those two triangles on the right-hand side and the left-hand side. It's a butterfly-looking pattern. And now you can properly interpret that and measure the linearity, the crossover distortion, the flat topping, and many of the characteristics of single sideband. That's one way of analyzing it. Another way would be a spectrum analyzer, but that's a bit more difficult. I wonder if you've done some of these analysis techniques or seen them in operation, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Now, Roger, yeah, I have built into my linear amplifiers, I got a couple of homebrew ones. I put these 1-inch Millen scopes in. I bought a number of them. They're 1-inch, 1CP1 scopes. They were made to fit in the same size opening as a panel meter. And exactly, that's what it displays. What it does, basically, it samples. You got a gimmick coupling for the RF to supply the horizontal sweep, and you got the audio coming in from the exciter RF in, I should say, that supplies the vertical. So when you're talking to the mic, you see a nice trapezoid, and you can see if you're underdriving it, it sort of concaves out the sides of the trapezoid, and if you're overmodulating it, you see it sort of rounds out. So that's a viable way. So you're saying that if you have a generic oscilloscope, let me let it drop. I'll try to make this clearer to everybody. And if you have a generic oscilloscope, that, of course, you see them a lot in them at the flea markets and all, very, very cheap, that you can use, like, for instance, RF, you can couple RF into the vertical, horizontal input, say, by, just wrapping something around the coax output of the transmitter, and then feeding the audio into the vertical input, like, in other words, drive the horizontal, or if, I guess, does it make a difference which way you do it, Dick? That's a good question. Would it make ideally, I guess you'd want, what, the vertical to be the audio input over?
Dick, I got the answer. Negatory. You definitely, 90% of the time, Mel, want the vertical to be RF and the horizontal to be audio. Eric says he's got the answer. Go ahead, Eric.
Very cute app. It's a software-defined radio. What he's talking about is a quadrature sampling detector. Okay, it's typically used in DSP for decoding different forms of modulation. Now, it's really complex, but to make it real simple, and I've done it with a Hilbert algorithm, but what you do is you actually take that RF and you do what they call quadrature sampling. You take, and you're actually making one signal which is in the time domain, and by using imaginary numbers, the other signal is part of the frequency domain. It'll take an hour to get really more complex about it, but there are a number of software-defined radio kits, the radio kit front ends, which you can use with that app, and if you go through the guy's website, he gives you a number of examples that you can work from, but that's the short and long of it, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to pass it over to Sam in a minute for confirmation of what you just said. So if you go to the website of the proper guy and mention what website that is, I think you're saying there's a reasonably good explanation of how this INQ software-defined radio function, this application, how it works. So if he Googles the right words, will you have any trouble finding that website, in your opinion, Mel, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
All right, let me correct you. His website doesn't give you an explanation. If you want to know how it works, what you do is you do a Google search for a quadrature sampling detector. But if you go to the Apple App Store, there's a button with the app that lets you go to his website, and he gives you examples of hardware you can buy to make the thing work.
Sam, if you're there, you have any further questions on this? KC2, Papa Uniform Yankee, K2RIW. Okay, looks like Sam got called away. Mel, I would strongly recommend most of the time, the RF that's doing the sniffing, you want to go to the vertical plates with the RF. the audio plates goes into the horizontal plates of the scope for a bunch of reasons. The horizontal input of most oscilloscopes is the much lower frequency response channel. I mean, if you've got an oscilloscope that goes to, let me pick a number, 50 megacycles, rarely will you have 50 megs of bandwidth on horizontal, but you might on the vertical. So I would recommend RF vertical, audio horizontal. That gives you the double trapezoid pattern that looks like an ordinary bow tie or an ordinary butterfly pattern. If you reverse audio and horizontal and vertical by putting the RF into the horizontal, if your scope will take it, and put the audio into the vertical, then that butterfly pattern would be turned up on end. A smart guy could still understand it, but it would be a very unconventional display compared to the articles you and I have read to date. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, that's why I wanted to make it clear. In other words, when you put the RF in, if you don't modulate it, you're going to see a vertical line on the scope, just a straight vertical line. And when you talk into the mic, you're going to see it fill into, like Dick says, a trapezoid type of figure or a bow tie type of figure, a double trapezoid, you may want to call it. But you'll see that effect. In other words, without modulation, actually, you can actually, if you're adjusting the transmitter and all, which you shouldn't do on the air, I mean, unless you pick dead times if you want to actually load it up, you'll actually see as the RF peaks that the vertical line will get longer. I think that's the best way to describe it, Dick. That, in other words, no modulation, vertical line. Talk into the mic, you get the horizontal sweep, correct? Over.
That's essentially what you would see with an amplitude modulated transmitter where there's a continuous carrier. I say no, Mel. In the case of a single sideband transmitter, when you do not speak into the microphone, even though the transmitter is keyed, when it's adjusted correctly, no RF energy comes out of that transmitter when you do not speak into that microphone. So therefore, the oscilloscope will show you nothing but a simple dot on the center of the screen. As you speak into the microphone and your audio is making horizontal sweep, you're sweeping the dot left and right across the screen with the plus and minus voltage out of your audio, then the single sideband transmitter is putting out RF, and then you get a vertical deflection. The vertical deflection will be maximum on the right-hand side and the left-hand side, and no vertical deflection in the center. That's why it looks like a bow tie pattern. So the magic of sideband is it saves your battery power. During the time you're not talking, you're not putting it on any power, and except for some bias current, you're not drawing any power out of the battery. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's a cool way to adjust the null adjustment.
It sure is. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, what I said is to make it clear that if they put RF continuous in, like to load the transmitter into an antenna without modulating it, just putting RF in, say, in CW position, they will know if they hooked it up, if it's working correct, they're going to see a vertical line on the scope. Correct, Dick, over.
Most of the time, I'm going to agree with that. You'd be amazed how many of the single sideband transmitters create Morse code by keying on and off audio. They put a 600 hertz sine wave. You've got a 600 hertz sine wave generator that each time you press down the key, the sine wave generator is coupled through the audio circuitry into the sideband transmitter. So many a sideband transmitter does it that way, Mel, in which case when you transmit Morse code, you will see you'll see this let me pick a number for it. What would you see in a case like that? Wow. That's a more complicated case. You are continuously putting out a sine wave of RF during the time you're putting in a 600 hertz sine wave of audio. Eric, do you have a guess as to what that kind of a transmitter would look like on a butterfly pattern? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
No, I suspect it would look like a butterfly.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think it would be the normal butterfly, the normal double trapezoid pattern, double triangle pattern. However, when you look at that with a spectrum analyzer, a pure tone going in with during key down, you put a brick on the key. On a spectrum analyzer, there'd be one single vertical line, 600 hertz above the carrier frequency, and the carrier frequency is not being transmitted. So the RF is thoroughly unmodulated. So since the RF in the Morse code mode of that particular type of transmitter, which is fairly popular, I'm not convinced that that one can make a butterfly pattern, because the RF is not being modulated in any way during the key down. Think about that one, Eric. It's a tough one. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, what shape would it be? I mean, you are actually using audio, although it's not varying in frequency. So, would it be a vertical line? Or would it have both horizontal and vertical deflection at the same time?
Victor David Henry with a comment.
Victor David Henry, start up with your name and your comment. Sounds like you've been there.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Yeah, this is WA2 Victor David Henry. Name is John. I was just listening. If you are putting out, feeding a single audio tone, let's take an example. Let's say you're at 14200, and you're putting a 1 kilohertz tone into the microphone, so you're putting a single RF sine wave. For upper sideband, you're putting a single RF sine wave at 14201. And so you're going to be, on your scope, you're deflecting a single RF sine wave with a sinusoidal 1 kilohertz horizontal sweep. It's just going to be, I think, brighter at the ends in the center, because the sine wave spends more time at its peak, but I don't think it's going to show any trapezoidal or any butterfly pattern. Go ahead.
Give that man a cigar. I think John's right on this one, Eric. Because that transmitter is absolutely unmodulated, it's putting out, in his example, a 14.201 megacycle signal with absolutely no modulation, because the tone is not changing in amplitude, and it's fixed in frequency, 1 kilohertz. The 1 kilohertz of audio will be sweeping the scope back and forth. The RF will be thoroughly unmodulated, therefore you'll get a rectangular bright spot on the screen. A pure rectangle where the upper and lower envelope are horizontal lines, and it'll be slightly brighter on the edges, on the outer edges, because the sine wave dwells there for a longer period of time. I'm beginning to slowly think the double trapezoid pattern is something you see with double sideband suppressed carrier modulation. I'm not quite as sure now as to what we're going to see with ordinary audio going into a single sideband transmitter. Do you see the problem here, Eric? Life's never simple. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
SIJI disconnecting.
I missed that, Dick. Yeah, well, is it single audio tone? If you're going to sweep with that same frequency, and it's going to be a constant amplitude, you're probably right there. Although, the vertical deflection is the detected amplitude of the RF. So, yeah, it's not going to be moving around anywhere, is it?
Comment.
You got it. It's a pure horizontal deflection, vertical constant amplitude deflected signal. It's a bright rectangle on the screen. Person who said comment, please identify your name and call letters. I should recognize you. K2RIW. Go ahead, comment.
Ed, K2GJE, you use a two-tone test signal to check the linearity of a linear amplifier, and that's how you'll get your trapezoid over.
Give that man a cigar. Ed, you came to our rescue. We were going down a crazy road. You're absolutely right, Ed. How come we forgot that, Mel and Eric? And we all forgot about the fact that true single sideband transmitter testing is done with a two-tone test, and you choose two tones that are not harmonically related to each other in order to really do a thorough test. Now those two tones beat against each other in a complicated manner. They do make a modulated carrier, and now you will get a double trapezoid pattern. It's slowly coming back to us. Do you remember that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW?
Well, you'd be 2HWW with a comment.
Eric, first, go ahead, Eric.
Absolutely. You know, a little brain freeze here. But, that's the way we generally fix most radios. I got my little box that does exactly that. Yeah, but the single frequency is going to be a single dot. Absolutely right.
A single frequency is not a single dot. It's got real RF continuously coming out with absolutely no modulation. And the audio is sweeping it across the screen. It'll make a pure rectangular bright spot. Howie, I wonder if you've done some two-tone testing. Go ahead, Howie.
No, but I can say one thing, Dick. When you're looking at a single sideband transmitter, you don't have to summon differences. If you're looking at a single sideband transmitter, you're removing one side, and that's it. So you only have one place of the energy. Well, if you've got a 1KC tone and you're transmitting at 14.2, you're going to be at 14.21. If you're running a double sideband transmitter, regardless of carrier or suppressed carrier, you've got to have a signal at 14.201 and a signal at 14.199.
Yeah, I agree with you. And double sideband transmitters are very unpopular. It's an easy thing to do with a doubly balanced mixer as an experiment in a laboratory. But to really do that and put it on the air, you'd be kind of unpopular. Mel, it looks to me like your mailbag is taking these old guys and teaching them some lessons. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
You meant KEY.
Sorry about that. Mel, go ahead. K2KEY.
Well, I was just about to say that. I was listening. I want to hear the comments. Yes, yes. The little Millen scopes I have in the panels there all produce a single trapezoid. Little triangles. If you tune the transmitter with continuous, tune up the amplifier or the exciter or whatever it is with a continuous carrier, you get a vertical line. If I'm on AM, if I'm operating it on AM, it fills in the vertical line, stays, and when you talk into it, it forms that trapezoid. But when you stop talking, you've got that vertical line. If you're in single sideband, the system, it's made so that the Millen has built into it that there was no detecting of RF. It extinguishes the dot, so you don't burn a spot into the middle of the phosphor of the screen because, you know, it has what they call intensified modulation system built into this little scope. So in other words, it intensifies the brightness. Let me let it drop. It intensifies the brightness as soon as you put RF in and forms a nice trapezoid. If you were back in the older days, and we were talking about that, the old phasing rigs, double sideband phasing rigs, did produce a double trapezoid. So that's the story. But or if you do a two-tone test, that's what I was going to tell you. That's when you're going to produce it. But I wanted to hear what everybody's commented before I accept, how it really looks. And as you say, you can do it very simple, and it is a good indication by just taking the audio and putting it into the horizontal deflection and picking up RF through a gimmick coupling. That means just detecting it, wrapping a piece of coil around the coax or whatever, going into the vertical input of the scope, and you'll get that kind of effect. You get, after a while, you get an idea of how loud to talk, you know, and everything, and when it looks right. Okay, I think we covered that. Go ahead, Dick.
WB2HWW with a proposal, Dick.
Howie recognized, in the case of a two-tone test, I think you are going to get at least a triangle, if not a double triangle pattern. And when you put speech in it, because the two tones, with a two-tone test, the two audio tones are literally beating against each other, and for short periods of time, the tone goes to zero when the two tones are out of phase, and later on, they're twice normal voltage when they're in phase. and speech consists of a whole lot of individual frequencies that beat against each other, so you will get a trapezoidal pattern with speech. But real single sideband testing has got to be done with two tones, not with one single tone. What's your proposal, Howie? K2RIW.
Two things. One thing is, before I give the proposal comment, I think the way you're supposed to do double, you know, AM detection with a scope is you go into the horizontal with a diode, rectify the RF, filter the RF, so you get the audio component. Instead of going to the mic, you go right into the horizontal, and a vertical, you do RF detection. My proposal was, maybe you take 1 hour, next week or the week after, at the beginning, and you spend 15 minutes on each mode. Talk about AM, talk about sideband, talk about FM. Explain that with single sideband, you get a, what is it, 6 dB improvement, whatever it is, two-thirds of power. Explain why they went from AM to sideband, because you put all your energy into one sideband. You got rid of the carrier. And that would be nice. Without doing too much math, just explain the differences between AM and sideband and the fact that we're allowed to go, what is it, 120% on a negative, 100% on a positive peak. And then you can maybe spend a few minutes on FM and just explain the difference between modulation index, you know, between the audio frequency rate and the deviation. The deviation is the maximum swing, and the modulation is how many times a second you go back and forth, you know, across the zero point. It would be nice if you can do that, and without having to go through all the calculus like we did at college level. That would be a great idea, Dick.
We did that last week, Howie. We went through FM and everything.
Yeah, I actually missed it, but I know most of the theory. I was just making that comment. You may want to do it on AM. Explain what AM there is. By the way, I don't know if you know this. I'm not involved in this, but there's a guy out here in Queens, Hal, K6DBZ, put up an AM repeater. So there is some actors, some people, Richie N2EO is on that repeater, and there's a lot of guys trying to get the old TX62s and the Clay 22s and all that old equipment back on AM, so you might want to spend some time on a different mode to compare the differences.
How are you listening back? We did that.
Hey, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's possible we've covered them at least. In order to just explain what really goes on with FM modulation, because Glenn and John were pretty heavily involved with a particular experiment where they were putting a spectrum analyzer-like device into the IF strip of an FM receiver, and much more difficult to interpret what's going on there. So in order to explain what I think was going on, I started off with a two-minute description of amplitude modulation, then went over to FM, and we went for more than an hour, hour and a half, trying to explain FM. FM and the Bessel functions, a little bit on the complicated side. You don't want to get too deep into that one. We did it for an hour and a half. Now, as far as sideband is concerned, we didn't tell anyone how to generate it, but there's lots of articles you can read about that. That's the complicated side, knowing that there are three or four generating techniques, but know that single sideband eliminates the lower carrier, so to speak, the carrier, the lower sideband transmits only the upper sideband, if that's the one you want to transmit. And depending on which expert you talk to, there's either 6 or 9 decibels of advantage of doing that. And it saves battery power, because when you're not talking, you're not putting out RF. So sideband's got a lot going for it. That's why it's so popular. Let me drop for one more.
Comment. To tell the people about how you can calibrate a spectrum analyzer and a deviation meter by using a Bessel function where at a certain tone frequency the carrier disappears?
Yes, we did explain that, and we explained why the carrier disappears. What was the point I was going to make? I forgot it. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, we went through all that. So no use going back on that. All right, I think we covered this pretty much, so getting close to 10 o'clock. All right, I think we'll let the rest go. I haven't got anything else here that looks pressing. There's a couple questions here. One of our interests here, but I guess I don't know if it's worth discussing, Dick. Over.
Dick, I'm going to get out of here, but I am going to listen to that lecture. Do you know what date that was? That TechNet date, believe it or not? I'm probably a little rusty.
That was either 1 or 2 weeks ago, and it was either the second or third hour of that particular TechNet. And so if you just simply skip through those hours 1 or 2 weeks ago, you'll find it pretty fast, because the FM discussion went on for more than an hour, probably an hour and a half at least. Mel, we've been promising that we're going to try to answer everybody who signs in the beginning during the first hour, and then flip over to the mailbag at approximately 9 o'clock. I think we've done that. Do you believe we fulfilled the requirements this week for the so-called new improved TechNet? KQKY, KQRIW.
Last week we got a little bit off the beaten path. Howie, if you want to listen, it was 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, Sunday before last, was the one on discussion on FM. Like Dick said, we did, it was more than an hour and a half. It was close to 2 hours, Dick. And we went through every kind of possibility of understanding the FM mode and whatever. So I think we'll just go on. Let's pick up the other questions. Let's see. I know there was some late sign-ins, and I don't want to get any emails that we sort of, skipping people. So pick up the other questions, Dick. That's the late sign-ins. Over.
The web address.
Yeah, we've got both Steve and Victor in that order. Steve, KC2MDP, one of the late sign-ins. Go right ahead with your question, Steve. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel, and everyone else out there on the net. Dick, my question concerns tonight a 23-centimeter mobile antenna I'm installing. Actually, I've installed on the vehicle. Now, I did a SWR check, and the lower end of the band, it's about, I'd say, maybe 1.2. The higher end of the band, it's about, 1.5, I'd say, maybe a little more than 1.5. Now, the strange thing is the middle of the band, around 1270, the SWR is 2.0, if not a little bit above it. I also tried adjusting this antenna, and the funny thing is I tried adjusting the width, and basically, there was no change at all. The only thing I could figure is maybe it's got something to do with cable length that's causing the high SWR in the middle of the band. It's also a mag mount. Would that have any effect on it? Back to you.
Yeah, you're now into a slightly controversial area here, Steve, where I'm going to tell you what I believe is a basic truth in physics. However, you say these words that I'm about to give you on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, you're going to get into a great big argument. In theory, standing wave ratio is really reverse power ratio. You're sending 50 watts down that cable. If the antenna was a pure 50-ohm load, it absorbs all of that 50 watts and, in theory, radiates all of it into space. If the antenna is anything but a 50-ohm resistor, and by the way, you can have a lot of fun with your fellow engineering friends by telling them, I've got a variable capacitor in a perfectly shielded box at the end of a coax cable, and I've carefully adjusted that capacitor to be exactly 50 ohms of reactance. And I put that at the end of the cable. What will the standing wave ratio be? Boy, you get a very critical look out of 90% of the engineers. They have a lot of trouble with that one. And the answer is you'd get an infinite standing wave ratio. A good capacitor cannot continuously absorb power. Only a resistor can. So if your anything is, if your antenna is anything but a 50 ohm resistor, pure resistor, then some amount of the power you send to that antenna will be reflected. You could call it reverse power ratio. If you measure it on a network analyzer, it's called S11, voltage reflection coefficient. It's got lots of names. But the lack of proper impedance of the load means that some amount of power comes back. The amount of power that comes back, if you've got reasonably low loss line, does not change with line length. So in the pure world, changing the coax cable length does not change the VISWR. on many a network, many a standing wave ratio indicating device that you've got. Standing wave ratio bridge, and maybe a bird watt meter that's not up to snuff as far as its high directivity is concerned. There's many a situation where, as you change the length of the feed line, what you measure for VisWar in the shack will go up and down. But in theory, it shouldn't be happening. It usually indicates more than one error is occurring when you see that. So changing line length is not supposed to change standing wave ratio. However, as you change the line length, the VisWar is of the same magnitude, but that amount of VisWar is a circle of possible impedances on a Smith chart. The diameter of the circle is the magnitude of the VisWar, so to speak. So there's a whole bunch of dots along that circle where any one of those will be a 2-to-1 VisWar. But as you change the line length, you're changing the phase angle of the reflected power. Not its magnitude, only its phase angle. And at certain phase angles, your particular antenna tuner can handle it and not handle it. Let me drop. So there's good reason for changing the line length. Not because it changes the VisWar, but changes the phase angle of VisWar, which goes into the good region where your network, your particular antenna tuner can handle it. Now, the fact that your antenna has better VisWar on the ends and lousier in the middle, it's got the upside-down bathtub curve, if you know what I mean. That's not supposed to happen. The fact that it's a mag mount shouldn't be doing it. The fact that you've got a particular feed line length that shouldn't be doing it. Assuming your standing wave ratio bridge is telling you the truth, and here's something to worry about. Many a standing wave ratio bridge, depending on its method of manufacture, works like a charm on 10 meters, 6 meters, starts becoming a little bit inaccurate on 2 meters, more inaccurate on 432, and is really terrible on 1296. Before you condemn that antenna, I would strongly recommend that you get a hold of any other standing wave ratio indicating device, somebody else's VisWar meter, somebody's network analyzer, Andy's service monitor, a bird watt meter, or whatever, some other device, and make sure that you confirm that the reading really is worse in the middle. Very few things can do that. So there's a slim possibility it's a false alarm here. What is the brand name of the machine you're using, Steve, to measure that standing wave ratio? We say it's impossible, but it's an unusual case. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, it's Diamond Antenna manufactures it, actually. And it's got different bands on it. Let's see, it's got HF, and it's 430 to 450, 800 to 930, and then 1240 to 1300. Yeah, that sort of struck me funny, too, that it would be higher in the middle. I've never experienced that one yet. Back to you.
There's a way you can confirm that your diamond is telling you the truth at the 1296 band across the low, medium, and high end of the band that you're measuring. First of all, if you've got a known good termination that you really believe is good at 1296 megacycles, put it on the end of a cable, put it on that diamond antenna meter, matcher, and see what it reads. If it's a real good dummy load, you should read something like 1.1 to 1 or better across the whole band. That's test number one. Test number two would be to intentionally create a mismatch. If you've got a T connector that you trust that works well at 1296, and you put a dummy load on both ends of the T connector, and now you look at the common port, by definition, you're not looking at 50 ohms, you're looking at 25 ohms. That is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Will your antenna tuner, your VisWar measuring meter, your diamond thing, will it measure something very close to 2-to-1 VisWar across the band? If it passes those two tests, the first test proved that it's got good directivity. The second test strongly indicates it's got reasonable calibration. So with the stuff that you can lay your hands on, or maybe you can borrow it from Andy, you can create known good load and a known amount of mismatch and see if the machine is telling the truth. After that, you ought to bring that antenna down and show it to us when we're at the February 27th get-together in Levittown Hall, the next flea market of Limark, and we ought to take a look at that antenna because it's rather unusual to have an upside-down bathtub curve. I wonder if you think you have the ability with the dummy loads you've got in the shack to do that test, Steve, and or g- get a hold of somebody else's VisWa measuring device, like a bird watt meter, that you trust at that frequency region. KC2MDP, K2LIW.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
It's a strange thing, but it's not really normal performance. And I've seen stuff like this where you can get that kind of performance. And a lot of times when I'm measuring antennas and I'm setting them up for mobile, I use the MFJ antenna analyzer. And time what I've learned is that I use a nice long cable, something like 10 feet, to get out of the near field of the antenna. Originally, I was experimenting with a small 3 foot, almost like patch cable between the antenna, and when I was standing near it, I was getting all kinds of crazy results. But by using like a 10 foot cable and getting far enough away from the antenna, so I was at least a good 10 feet away from the antenna, and did the sweep, usually I get good performance. I'm just wondering, maybe he might be standing too close to the antenna when he's trying to take these measurements and getting a strange effect with the instrumentation. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
A very good suggestion, Glenn. When you get up to a frequency as high as 1296, what you think is a well-shielded box, Steve, almost everything is a poor shield. And so the RF energy out of that antenna, getting back into the logic of that network analyzer, of that Diamond VisWa measuring device, could be aggravating it. So a much longer feed line of reasonably low loss is a much nicer way to go. Put more separation between you and the antenna when you're making the measurement. And while you're at it, if you've got a nice long piece of coax cable you're pretty sure is not filled up with water, and it's got a lot of loss, that may be the world's best way of making an extremely good 50-ohm dummy load as far as the first test is concerned. A very long, lossy piece of cable will have a surge impedance of 50 ohms no matter what you've got at the far end if the loss is high enough. And let me show you what I'm talking about here. If you've got a long enough piece of cable that you know has got 10 decibels of loss at 1296, then maybe it's a 50-foot length of cable, and you've got a pure open circuit at the end, you've got 10 dB of loss for the signal going down, it hits the open circuit, and all of it reflects back. But what reflects back gets another 10 dB of loss. Therefore, you've got 20 dB of loss by the time you come back to the real reflected signal you measure in the shack on that long piece of cable, even with no termination on the far end. A 20 decibel reflection coefficient is something like a 1.18 or so standing wave ratio. It's extremely good. But even a yucky termination at the far end, hang a 50-ohm resistor on there with clip-lead, so to speak, and you're probably going to have a system that's got a 1.1 or better standing wave ratio. So making a good dummy load and making a pair of them to do the directivity test, that's the first one, with a pure 50-ohm load, and the approximate calibration test, that's a pair of 50-ohm loads, you'd be amazed with the stuff you already own how easy it is to do it when you get smart enough, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW, the TechNet. By the way, with
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you do make these measurements and make these discoveries, please come back and tell us what you found. Over to you, Steve.
Dick, I have a comment here.
Stand by, Howie. Steve first. Go ahead, Steve.
Stand by.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yes, that's a lot of food for thought. I don't have anything here as far as a dummy load that I think is good for 23 centimeter, but that's easily remedied with a couple of bucks. And as far as, when I did the test, no, I was way below. I was actually in the car doing this test. But between the transmitter and the actual SWR meter was probably only maybe, an 18 or a 20-inch piece of coax. And then the coax going to the mag mount, that's got to be, I'd say, probably about 10, 12 feet thereabouts. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you had more enough, and you being more than enough length between you and the antenna, and you being in the car with the antenna on the mag mount on the roof, assuming it's not a plastic roof car, I think you've done a fairly valid test. You've now got to confirm that your diamond is telling you the truth. It might be, but some simple testing can do it. And even if you don't think you've got a good dummy load, if you've got a lossy piece of coax cable, you can make a dummy load. And if you're a little bit crafty with these surface mount resistors, as long as you're not trying to put a whole lot of watts into them, you'd be amazed how easy it is to take surface mount resistors, the kind that are made for printed circuit board, they got essentially no leads on them, and carefully solder that into the middle of a 50-ohm coaxial connector, SMA, BNC, type N, UHF, whatever. And so you can make a pretty good dummy load with small length resistors. Go ahead with your comment, Howie.
Go ahead. My first question is this, Dick. That mag mount from Diamond and the antenna, does the mag mount have plastic underneath it? A lot of these mag mounts are capacitively coupled. It's not an electrical connection to the ground, to the car. So you're capacitively coupled on the ground side. That's number two, even though the shield gets terminated. And usually those antennas are high-gain antennas, so you could have an LC situation there at those frequencies, Dick. Even though you're really a high frequency, and that capacitor should really have no reactance. I've seen situations where both antennas don't behave right.
This call. If the antenna was properly designed, it has a chunk of plastic on the bottom to make sure that the metal of the magnet is not scraping the paint of the car and leaving scratches. And even though the antenna itself is not thoroughly grounded like it would if you drilled a hole through the sheet metal, with proper design, that series coupling capacitor could be part of the antenna, and you can still get a very good visual in that environment. And yes, you'll get a change. The fact that you eliminate the plastic and now it behaves differently, that's normal physics. If the antenna was properly designed for the presence of that plastic to protect the paint of the car, that should be a good performing antenna. So there are lots of people who think you can't make a good antenna with a capacitive couple on the bottom between the mag mount and the roof of the car. I disagree on that one. With proper design, that can be made work like a charm. So good luck with those measurements, Steve, and whenever you find something, let us know. Victor was the next person on our list, W82 Alpha Romeo Quebec. Go right ahead with your question, Victor.
Second, Dick, N2EO. Put me at the end, please.
You're on the list. Go ahead, Victor. W82ARQ, Alpha Romeo Quebec. You still there, Victor? K2LIW? Victor sounds like he's gone. Rich, you just bubbled to the top of the list, N2EO. What's going on in Whitestone? K2LIW?
Okay, good evening, Dick, N2EO. Yeah, I checked in late because I was making some measurements with respect to my question. You answered part of the question in the last last person with a 23-centimeter question. And one thing is you said that may have a... That's apropos to what I'm going to ask is that for an antenna to absorb RF, it has to be 50-ohm, or the impedance has to be resistively matched, not reactively matched. My question, Dick, he said, I have a Cushcraft R8 vertical in the backyard. It's about 12 feet off the ground. It's been up about 13 years, and I'm noticing that the loading adjustment on the transmitter has changed a little bit. It's not terrible, but something is going wrong, and the coaxial cable that runs, by the way, that's the ground-independent vertical, so electrical halfway vertical. The coax is, I bought 13 years ago, Belden cable that was rated for direct burial, and it goes under the ground into the basement. Now, I don't want to condemn the cable right away, but I suspect it. I put the MFJ analyzer on it this evening, and at resonance on all bands, I'm seeing about 20 ohms of reactance. I forget now if it's capacitive or inductive reactance, but as I go up in frequency with the MFJ analyzer, I'm trying to remember now, I think the resistive impedance is going down, and as I go down in frequency, the resistive impedance is going up. I should say the resistive component. I'm wondering what you think, Dick. You know, when I did the test for coax loss, it's saying 5.8 dB of loss. That's on 20 meters, that's an awful lot. I can't believe that.
Did you end your question? Because you seem to stop abruptly, Rich. I'm not quite sure whether or not you've got a chance to pose your whole question. Go ahead.
Get a hit! It's too ill. I'm just, you know, as I'm thinking and talking, and I don't walk and chew gum at the same time.
Okay, I just did a quick calculation here, if I did it correctly. If the antenna, just as an example, was a 50-ohm resistor, and it also had 20 ohms of reactance, doesn't matter if it's capacitive or inductive, 20 ohms of reactance on a 50-ohm antenna, that as a combination would be a standing wave ratio of 1.48, reflection coefficient of 14 dB. When you're making these VizWire measurements, the fact that you're seeing a reactance, and 20 ohms may sound pretty horrible to you, but if the net result is a 1.4 standing wave ratio, 1.48, 1.47, I think is the number I just calculated. Yeah, 1.48. That's not a showstopper to me. And if you actually look, what's that losing you in forward transmitted power, it's something in the vicinity of 2/10 of a dB of loss, an extremely small fraction of a well-calibrated S-meter, if you know what I mean. So, first of all, you may be worrying about something that's a little bit academic. It's not a showstopper. It's not going to crash and burn and catch on fire and smoke and do all kinds of terrible things. You can also try replacing the coax cable with a short piece during the measurement just to see if your cable is a factor. Although I think you're making it sound like you're making the measurement with the MFJ right at the antenna, not necessarily in the shack. And then whether or not your body nearby is contributing to the problem. Let me drop.
Dick, I'm measuring it in the shack with the... You know, I disconnected the radio and hooked the MFJ right in the shack.
Now, when's the last time, though, that your MFJ has had a good dummy load on it to see that it reads 1.1 or under with a good dummy load across the frequency band of interest and then put a known mismatch, like a pair of 50 ohms on a T-connector so that you know it should have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio and does it read close to 2-to-1 across the band? Have you had a chance to do any of that kind of measurements with your MFJ any time in the recent past? Rich, go ahead.
I put a 50-ohm load on it today. It is reading 1.1 to 1 across the whole range. Did not try two loads to see if it's 2-to-1 or 25 ohms. The thing I questioned was... it's saying, you know, when I go to read the coax loss, it's saying 5.8 dB, and I don't think that's possible with what I'm getting. It seems like an awful lot. I think it's lying to me.
Okay, you believe your cable is now reading 5 dB of loss. How did you make that measurement? Did you open circuit the far end and measure how much comes back in decibels and then divide the number by 2 in decibels? Or how did you measure the loss of the cable? Over to you, Rich.
Okay, well, the MFJ analyzer, which I got to admit, I'm not that familiar with it. It has a function to read coax loss. That's what I used, and I really question it. The measurement you came up with, 1.5-to-1, is about what I'm getting. Actually, it's saying about 1.7-to-1 SWR, but that's close enough for government work. I think what's bothering me might be a little academic. What I've noticed is that as I go up the band on 20 meters, for instance, the loading capacitor on the Collins KWM2, they say a load for 230 mils. I have to keep increasing the loading cap, the adjustment, to maintain 230 mils as I go up the band. As I go down the band, it's more normal. Now, I never noticed that before. Back to that.
When you use the MFJ to measure coax cable loss, tell me what steps it told you to do. In other words, if the antenna was connected at the time it's predicting the loss, I'm positive the machine cannot measure loss in that condition. So what were the steps by which it measured insertion loss of your cable? Over to you, Rich.
Not sure, Dick. Like I say, I'm not familiar with that function. I probably did something in error. What I can tell you, what I'm reasonably sure of, is that I'm seeing 20 ohms of reactance, 50 ohms of resistance, and I don't know. Like I say, maybe it's academic. What's got me going is the fact that the plate loading adjustment has changed from what it was some time ago. And so that's when I started using the analyzer, which I'm not totally familiar with. So I may be leading you astray.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I think your cable might be directly buried. So a change in the cable is certainly something to be suspicious of. Also, I'm getting the impression from what you said and what you didn't say that the insertion loss of the coax cable function of your MFJ was done with the antenna connected. You cannot do that. I mean, if the antenna was perfect, a pure 50-ohm load, or if you had a pure 50-ohm dummy load at the far end of the cable, and perfect cable and perfect connectors, all signal going down the cable would be absorbed, nothing would come back, and therefore the MFJ, unless it's got some really fancy artificial intelligence of some kind and clairvoyance, it would have no way of knowing you've got a perfect 50-ohm dummy load in the shack connected to it, or a zillion feet of cable that's got a zillion dB of loss. They would look the same. There's no way you could make that measurement. So if there was no change in the antenna end of the cable during the measurement, then you may have followed some particular procedure in there, but I'm not sure you really measured the insertion loss of the cable. It looks to me like whichever one you do first, let me drop. I'm not sure which one you're going to do first. Either check the calibration of the MFJ by the means that we've already just discussed, or try substituting a piece of another piece of cable going out to the antenna. The antenna itself could have changed, the cable could have changed, and I think water getting in the cable, even though you think the ends are well sealed, but the cable, after X number of years, changing in its characteristics, particularly if it's buried, is certainly something to be suspicious of. You don't have a failure problem by far. You just got the early indication of something changing that's making you less than happy. And so by substitution tests of either dummy loads or substitution tests of cable, or making a measurement right at the antenna itself, you'll eventually find out what's going on. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, so K2RIW, N2EO. Well, I thought maybe you might be able to put your hands on it when I mentioned at residence there's 20 ohms of reactance. And I do suspect the cable. I wonder what your thoughts are again. It's Belden cable that's 13 years old. I bought this particular cable because it was rated for direct burial, but it's been buried for 13 years, so I don't know if it's become porous. The only connector is the connector at the base of the antenna, and then it runs right into the shack, so that's not an issue except the one connector at the antenna. From what you're telling me, Dick, I think what I'm going to do is do that second test with two dummy loads and take a reading, and then I think I'm going to use a short piece, maybe 10 feet, of a known good cable outside when the snow clears, and to take a direct reading on the antenna. What do you think, Antonio?
Those are good moves. The Belden cable, what model number was it? If you happen to know, Rich, go ahead.
No, I don't remember. I do remember I bought it from AES, and it was a Belden cable that they told me was, I don't know why I remember. I remember they told me it was rated for direct burial. I don't remember the number.
Okay, the cable itself, do you believe it's an air-filled cable, a foam-filled cable, polyethylene cable? What do you believe is the dielectric of the coax cable, Rich? Go ahead.
Well, it's a polyethylene cable.
If it's solid polyethylene and not foam polyethylene, very difficult to get water absorption in a cable like that. That's my favorite kind of cable, to go for the jumper that goes around the rotator at the top of the tower. Solid polyethylene cable is almost impervious to water by my standards, even though it's got a little bit of extra loss. RG9 is one of my favorites.